Hello, and welcome to a live telephone town hall with Santa Clara County Supervisor Joe Simidian and Santa Clara County Deputy District Attorney Angela Alvarado. I'm Melinda Jackson, Chair of the Political Science Department at San Jose State University. Our telephone town hall this morning is on the important issue of digital safety and online privacy. If you would like, at any time during our program, to ask a question, you can press 9 on your telephone to be connected to one of our screeners. But first, let me briefly introduce our guests. President of the Santa Clara County Board of Supervisors and former State Senator Joe Simidian. Joe Simidian was elected to the Santa Clara County Board of Supervisors in 2012 and was reelected in 2016 after serving 12 years in the California State Legislature. From 2004 until 2012, he represented the 11th State Senate District, which includes over 930,000 residents spread throughout San Mateo, Santa Clara, and Santa Cruz counties. From 2000 until 2004, he represented the 21st State Assembly District. He has been named one of the Scientific American 50 Leaders in Technology by Scientific American magazine. He has also authored numerous bills protecting privacy and data security, including the nation's first data breach notification law in 2012, versions of which now exist in 47 states. We also have with us Angela Alvarado. Angela has been a deputy district attorney for Santa Clara County for 19 years. She has served as trial attorney on the sexual assault, family violence, three strikes, general felony units, and juvenile justice units. She is currently assigned to the community prosecution team and works in the areas of crime prevention, law enforcement training, truancy, and digital safety. She has been a statewide instructor for law enforcement on the topics of juvenile crime, sexual assault, child abuse, human trafficking, and courtroom testimony for over 10 years. Angela is an expert in the areas of digital safety and the law. We're here today to discuss the issues of digital privacy and how you can keep you and your family safe online. There will be a chance to ask questions of the panelists after the initial discussion, so if you want to ask a question, press 9 at any time during the call. Again, if you want to ask a question, just press 9. First, I'll ask the panelists a few questions of my own to kick off the discussion. Then, for the remainder of the call, our panelists will answer questions directly from you. Supervisor Joe Simidian, you've been working on these issues since your time in the State Assembly. How have you seen the issue of online privacy change over the years, and what have we done to keep up with those changes?
Well, I think the challenge that all of us experience is that the technology just changes faster and faster, and it's frankly difficult for lawmakers at every level to keep up. Certainly when I was in the state legislature from 2000 to 2012, we saw the rapid evolution of the technology, more and more activity taking place online, and the question was, can we keep up? And the approach we took was to try and regulate the behavior or the conduct rather than the technology, knowing that the technology would change in a matter of years, if not months, if not weeks sometimes. Back in 2002 when I authored the data breach law that required folks who had had a data breach and to inform you when your personal information had been compromised, that was considered a pretty radical step at the time. People thought that was a big deal, and at one level it was. California was the first state in the nation, but as you mentioned, today we've got 47 states, most of whom have based their protections on the California law that, as I say, 15 years ago was considered a big deal. So the question is always, how can we stay current, if not ahead, of the technology? And that's tough to do. It means that the work is never going to be done in terms of lawmaking. And then similarly, in my current role as a county supervisor, here in Santa Clara County, where we have the obligation to run the $6.5 billion a year enterprise that is county government, we've got personal information for 1.9 million residents in Santa Clara County. So one of the first questions I asked when I came back to the board a few years back was, what are we doing to make sure that we keep that information safe? And again, can we stay one step ahead of folks who are finding ever more ingenious and threatening ways to compromise that information? So I would say it's the never-ending challenge of staying at least current, if not ahead, of the technology and the folks who would abuse the
Let me just remind our listeners, if you have a question at any point, please press 9 to be connected to one of our screeners. Thank you, Supervisor Simidian. Angela Alvarado, with kids getting online earlier than ever, what do you think parents should know before they give their kids smartphones or tablets and start connecting them to the internet?
Well, Melinda, I still remember when I got my first cell phone, and it was pretty much the size of a tiny computer. It was giant, and it was used for its intended purpose, which is to make phone calls. And the primary purpose was to make sure that my parents were able to get in contact with me. But that landscape has changed quite a bit. And now we are looking at a level of technology that when we give our children a, like you said, smartphone, a device, we're giving them a rocket ship into the internet. And when I tell parents, when we start this initial talk about giving your child their first real device to access the internet, they say, well, I'm giving my child a phone. I remind them, you know, we think it's a phone. It's really their first ticket to freedom. Like when we got car keys, and we go, oh, now I get to escape. That's really what a smartphone and a tablet is now for our young people. It's their gateway into a universe that some are ready for and some aren't. So my first bit of advice is before you give them a device, think about when you are going to give them, at a much later age, keys to a car. Because now kids are getting their smartphones and their tablets and their devices at ages far before you're going to get a driver's license. And you wouldn't give them the keys to your Ferrari or your sports car. We all learned how to drive on cars that our parents didn't care too much about if something happens. And then remember how that played out. It was a watch the other drivers, make sure you drive slow, pay attention. There are police officers that might give you a ticket. We need to approach their first introduction into using a device much like we would give them keys to a car.
Before we move on to our next topic, we wanted to find out what you, our listeners, thought about these issues. How early do you think it is appropriate to let your kids start using social media or other online tools? Press 1 if you think no age is too young. Press 2 if you think your child should have access while in middle school. And press 3 if you think that your child should wait until high school. And let me remind everyone again that if you have a question for the panel, just press 9, and you'll be connected to one of the screeners. Supervisor Simidian, I understand that this is something you've worked on during your time in the legislature and here at the county. What sort of protections are there for all of the information we have online, and what should we be doing to make sure it's safe?
Well, I think, all of us have a role to play, but all of us have to play our role, I guess I would put it that way. As a state legislator, I was acutely aware of the fact that during the years I was in Sacramento, there was a lot of work to be done. And so with my colleagues, I tried to make sure we got that work done. But passing legislation, even in a state as large as California, when you're dealing with a global phenomenon like the online world, has its limits. There's no question about that. That being said, we laid down what I thought was at least a good beginning in terms of what kind of expectations we had. So, for example, the data breach law that requires that if your information has been compromised, you're told so that you can protect yourself. Also authored legislation during that time that required anyone who was doing business online to have a privacy policy, to post it conspicuously, and then to honor the terms of the privacy policy, however weak or strong it might be, to at least make sure that that was something that was enforceable for you. And then, the technology changed, the use of the technology changed, and I had a very interesting case that was brought to me here in Santa Clara County, actually by one of my constituents who had been the victim of what's known as e-personation online, malicious e-personation, where someone essentially took over their identity and communicated with folks in ways that were very damaging. And turned out when he went to law enforcement, they said, well, there's no law on the books. It turned out that there was a law on the books, but it dated back to the late 1800s and wasn't really very applicable to the online world. So as I mentioned at the outset, part of what those of us in elected positions can do is provide the legal framework to talk about what's right, what's wrong, what's allowed, what's not, knowing that there are limitations. Then in the current role as I have, we really have tried to step up our game at the county because we have so much personal information, both in our health and hospital system, but also throughout the rest of the organization. And I take that responsibility very seriously. So I have been pushing the organization to beef up our data protection, our data security efforts, make sure that we are as well protected as we can be against kinds of hacking and denial of service attacks that other people and other organizations. All of that being said, the reason I'm so pleased that Angela's here from the District Attorney's Office is ultimately it comes down to a fair measure of individual responsibility and conduct for taking care of yourself, protecting yourself in that environment. And then if you are abused, making sure that you go to law enforcement. You know, I see this as, let's put good laws in place, let's take the necessary steps as an organization, then let's make sure that we've got law enforcement at the ready to the extent that they can be part of the solution. But first and foremost, I think we've all got to accept the responsibility to protect ourselves and do the things that will give us not absolute protection, but at least some modicum of protection.
Thank you. Let me remind people again that if you have a question for either of the panelists, just press 9 on your phone. You'll be connected to a screener and have the chance to ask your question live. I'd also like to repeat our poll question. The question is, how early do you think it is appropriate to let your kids start using social media or other online tools? Press 1 if you think no age is too young. Press 2 if you think your child should have access while in middle school. And press 3 if you think that your child should wait until high school. Angela, with all the apps, accounts, and devices we use, a lot of our personal information ends up online. Do you have any tips that both parents and their children should keep in mind when using online services?
As Supervisor Simidian said, this is a really exciting area of the law because this is one of those specific areas where we can take real proactive measures in protecting ourselves. And so when we started to look at kind of the digital landscape and look at it from a legal perspective, we wanted to be on the end of being proactive instead of just reactive. We tend to sometimes, especially on the law enforcement side of things, react when something's already happened. So like Supervisor Simidian said, we're a little bit behind the ball. So something that both parents and children and all of us can really take a look at with our online security and making sure we're, you know, kind of up to date is before we download anything, before we download an app, before we enter our personal information into a vacation booking website or anything, is to really check out their privacy settings. Check out how you can remove your information. It's interesting to see how many people, you know, if you go to your Amazon account, for example, and you've got all these credit cards that have expired, but have you cleared them? You really have to stay on top of cleaning up your personal information that doesn't need to remain on that particular website. So the first thing I would say is check out that app or that website and find out either why they need the personal information, how to remove your personal information, and who is going to see it. Are they going to use it for a third-party purpose that maybe you don't know about? And I ask people all the time when we give these presentations, and we're very active in the community as part of our crime prevention education, and District Attorney Rosen has made it very accessible for community members to contact either our office or Supervisor Simidian's office and request presentations on either identity theft, digital security, or digital safety for their minors and students, people, young people in their home. But something that's really important to remember is that we have a lot of this within our control, and a lot of it is within our control. And I ask people when we give these presentations, did you read the privacy policy before you downloaded that app? Before you upgraded your operating system on your phone, did you read it? Of course we don't read it. I'm one of those people that put off even upgrading my system as long as I possibly can, later. But really, that's part of our own digital health. we need to keep up our digital responsibility to protect our private information as much as we can.
Okay, good tips. Thank you. Before we go to our first listener question, I'd like to remind you all to press 9 if you have a question for us, and we also have the results of the poll question for you. 18% of people responded that no age is too young in terms of letting kids start to use social media or online tools. 30% said they should wait until middle school, and 52%, a majority, said they should wait until high school.
Yes, the question I would ask, Angela, in your experience, because you're out there in the community, does that square with the real world? Because my sense is that kids are accessing the technology at younger and younger ages.
They are. In fact, we've been doing kind of informal polls at both middle schools and high schools all around Santa Clara County, and these are students that have told us without hesitation that about 65% of our students are on social media and have social media accounts even before the age of 12.
We'd now like to take some questions from our listeners. I'd like to remind you all again that if you have a question, please press 9. But first, we have a question from Ellen in Los Gatos. Ellen, what's your question? Ellen, are you there?
Okay. Yes, I am.
Oh, okay, Ellen,
yeah.
Please.
One of my concerns is at this point is that your information fades in and out, so the it's not coming across in a consistent way. The other question I had is, any recommendations for kids that get addicted? You get a lot of kids starting in mid school and more so in high school, second and third year, so addicted to use of YouTubes and other distractions that homework's not done. They're up to all kinds of hours at night. Do you have any suggestions?
Yes, I'm so glad you asked that question because we are seeing an increase in not only our young people but even our adults addicted to technology. I would say my first line of defense is to have an actual time where everything gets turned off at home. Everything gets turned off. That means that 10 p.m., I'm not checking my email. I'm not checking my phone. Every student is not going to, you know, be maybe checking, you know, their game status and seeing where their rankings. We have so many of our students that really get addicted to gaming, and that's an area we're really starting to look at. But if parents have concerns, if they feel like they've crossed the threshold that they can't control at home, it feels like the boundaries aren't working, we have so many great community resources that are actually looking at digital use as an addiction. And we're getting a lot of students coming in saying, you know what, I'm on my computer too much. I'm on my smartphone too much. How can you help me?
Well, and, you know, I would just observe as I talked to experts in the field, one of the things I heard was that if the problem has already developed, that suggests that maybe the parents just didn't think to engage on this topic at an earlier age before the problem got out of hand. So the reminder that I was always given as I was working in this field was, challenging as it may be, parents need to engage with their young earlier and earlier ages before and set some limits before this kind of behavior gets out of hand. It's tougher to remediate.
That's such a great point, Supervisor Simidian, because many students will tell us, I can't talk to my parent because they don't even understand what, for example, Snapchat is, or they don't understand the game Fortnite. I can't talk to them. And when we were all growing up, family night was like game night or movie night. But our students tell us they want to have family Minecraft night or family night where they're, and I'm thinking, oh goodness, I just don't want to learn this. But they don't feel like they can come and talk to us because we don't know the technology. And I remind parents, they might be ahead of us on the technology, but we have the experience. We have the experience. They don't. So boundaries are really important to set at the youngest age you possibly can.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to remind everyone again that if you have a question for our panel, please press 9. You'll be connected to a screener and then have the opportunity to ask your question. We do have another question. I'm going to go now to Francis in Cupertino. Francis, are you there?
Yes. And what I want to know is if it is safe to pay your bills on the tablet instead of a computer. Is it easier to hack into, or is it okay?
Francis, and this is Angela Alvarado responding for you. Francis, the one thing that you always need to look at when you're entering your personal information, especially paying a bill or doing any kind of transaction, look for that lock in the corner of your web browser. That lock gives you a lot of information. That lock is going to tell you that the site is encrypted and it's okay to enter, for the most part, your personal information. So you always got to look for that lock. That's kind of your checkbox that things are working okay. With that being said, always be careful when you're on a public wireless network. Really be careful when you're giving any kind of personal information, whether you're in a coffee shop or a library, airports, hotels. You always want to look for that lock before you start transmitting your personal information.
Good tips. Thank you. Okay. Let me remind people again to please press 9 if you'd like to ask a question. And we're going to go to our next caller, Stephanie in Palo Alto. Stephanie, please go ahead with your question.
Hi, my question is actually ahead of the digital data problems. What about the county guarding our private information, like our phone numbers, when we bought our house, if we rent, etc.? We are getting barraged on a daily basis from contractors, whether they're heating, air conditioning, remodeling, gardening, what have you. And they all, when pressed, they will say, well, they get the information from the county. Why isn't that private? How can we protect ourselves from that kind of invasion of privacy?
This is County Supervisor Joe Simidian, and I'm going to ask that you let me do a little more research on that topic, because that's a new piece of data for me with respect to contractors in particular. But one of the points I would make is that whenever you're asked to provide information, even at the county, you should always ask, am I required to provide that information? And if so, says who? And I don't mean that in a flippant way. I'll just give you an example. At the Registrar of Voters, for example, lots of folks provide their phone numbers, lots of folks provide their email address, but they're not obliged to. Just because there's a request for the information or a place where the information can be provided, doesn't mean that you necessarily have to provide that information. If it's out there in the public arena, as we've now all learned, it's going to move around pretty quickly. But the first question I would ask, whether you're dealing with the county, another governmental entity, or certainly with any private organization, is that required? And if so, why? And says who? But as to the contractors in particular, I'll go back to our county planning department and see if I can find out a little bit more about that. And make sure that we are respecting and protecting people's privacy, and that if information is requested that's not required, that people know just that fact. Just a little footnote on that. When I first came back to the Board of Supervisors in 2013, it turned out that this kind of information was being requested at the county animal shelter, and people were providing it. And what they didn't know was that when they provided it, it was in part because of a deal the county had struck with a dog food manufacturer that was providing, quote, free dog food for the animal shelter, but in exchange, in fact, for access to folks' information for marketing purposes. I thought that was wholly inappropriate and said, if we have to, then let's pay for the dog food ourselves, but I don't want the county to be in the position of sharing people's personal information. So I'll follow up on the planning department and the contractor issue, and again, always ask.
Okay. Let me remind people again that if you have a question, please press 9 to be connected to a screener. I'd like to ask Angela, what steps should people take if they see abusive language or content online?
Well, if they see abusive content, language online, inappropriate messages, inappropriate solicitation online, I would say the first place to always report is the police department. If it's, especially if it's a case that involves juveniles, we have a number of resources in the county, both in local law enforcement agencies and in the DA's office. One of the real proactive things that we're doing, and District Attorney Rosen wanted to really highlight this particular last couple school years, that if something happens on a campus, we want to repair that campus climate and that campus culture as much as possible. So we are going to have prosecutors out in the community go out and educate parents and students on everything that they can do online to be safe, to care for one another in the community, to not find themselves in the criminal justice system. That would probably be one of the first steps I would say to take. But the second step would definitely be to report to either the school if it's a juvenile issue or report to the site itself. I tell parents, make sure that before you're letting your students download any apps, even for us too, because sometimes we can be playing, let's say, Words with Friends, one of my favorites, and suddenly you'll get harassing messages on a Scrabble game. Look at that particular app and find out how you can report directly to the site. And most of the times that I've reported abuse online, I've had a response. So be very proactive in seeing things, and we tell our young people, standing up for others online.
The other thing I would just add is it sometimes requires a little persistence. You talk to folks in the school scene, you know, I say this as a former school board member and someone who stays in touch with local public education issues, and they'll tell you, look, it's so hard to manage the climate on a school campus when there are all these influences that are well beyond the boundaries of the local school. So if you find yourself dealing with a school principal or some other administrator or teacher who perhaps seems like they're not quite as responsive as you hope, give it a little time. Look for somebody else in the organization who may be a little bit more savvy on these tech issues, cyberbullying. I would say the same thing with local police departments. We're fortunate that here in the Valley, we've got a more technologically sophisticated group of folks in law enforcement than you might find in other parts of the state or the nation. But again, it's going to vary from department to department, and if you don't get the help you need at first, just take a deep breath and see if there's somebody else in the organization who can help. And again, that's why I'm so pleased that Angela's with us here today from our district attorney's office. I think people are often surprised that our district attorney's office is so front and center on these kinds of issues. It may not comport with their idea of a courtroom TV drama, but it's a Silicon Valley district attorney's office, and it's a
thank you. Just a reminder, you're listening to a live telephone town hall with Santa Clara County Supervisor Jiz Sanidian and Deputy District Attorney Angela Alvarado. I'm your moderator today, Melinda Jackson, Chair of the Political Science Department at San Jose State University. We're going to go next to Drew in Los Altos Hills. Drew, did you have a question for us?
Yes, my question is in regard to, I guess you'd call it, sort of passive information. My particular example is LinkedIn, which sometimes asks sort of obtuse questions that it resulted, in my case, in my husband's case, in them having access to the contact lists on our email accounts. And I, for the life of me, can't figure out how to undo that. So I'm wondering, maybe this is for the Mr. Smidian, is there any kind of legislation that would encourage organizations like LinkedIn or Facebook or things like that that make it a little bit more direct as to, you know, how to correct that or how to make sure you don't inadvertently give access to that?
I'm not aware of legislation on that front, but here's what I would like to suggest. I'm guessing. I find myself challenged with this all the time, that There is some form of control that's available, but that may not be readily apparent to you as the user, or there's some kind of opt-in, opt-out choice that realized was made, but was made in the process, at least that I have, but I hear about from others. But if I can just ask you to give my office a call on Monday and ask for Gabe at 408-299-5050, 408-299-5050. We work with the folks at LinkedIn from time to time, and we'll follow up and see if we can't get you. Okay?
Thank you. I'd like to remind people again to press 9 on your phone if you would like to ask a question. And we're going to go next to Vasant in Cupertino. Go ahead with your question, please.
Hi. I wanted to, I think a lot of people are genuinely interested in privacy, and I wanted to know what can a private citizen or any citizen do to, or what are the steps necessary to obtain some sort of amendment protecting citizens' rights to privacy?
This is Supervisor Simidian, and you know what I would say is I think it starts with communicating to your elected officials the fact that you care about the issue. One of the things that I was frustrated by during my 12 years legislating on this topic in Sacramento was the number of times I heard from colleagues, well, my constituents don't really care about these issues. And I think that was not an accurate assessment, but I think that sometimes these privacy issues can be a little abstract. They don't come up perhaps in a local legislator's town hall meeting. So, you know, it starts with just communicating the fact that you care. And also, I think it's important that as we talk about this issue, we talk about it in ways that are tangible and that people can wrap their arms around. When you start talking about privacy as a constitutional right, and here in California, it's an explicit constitutional right. The voters put it in our state constitution in the 70s. But whether it's the federal right to privacy under the federal constitution or the state right to privacy, it can be a little abstract and kind of a little airy, and I think people sort of it is an intellectual debate. When you start talking about identity theft and the software, all of a sudden the conversation gets a little more serious. When you start talking about the children that takes place, the conversation gets more serious. It's got to be tangible. So let your elected representatives know at every level, your state legislators, your federal legislators, the federal government, Congress, as you know, has been struggling to find consensus on much of anything, including the digital world. But I was frankly heartened by the debate over net neutrality when, you know, extraordinary numbers, I think it was some neutrality debate, and all of a sudden it was hard for people to dismiss. So I'm not saying that's a cure-all. I'm not saying that that's going to make the world a better place overnight, but it starts with your elected officials knowing you actually care about these issues, not letting them simply get abstract or intellectual ideas.
Okay, let me remind people again that if you have a question, please press 9 to be connected to our screeners.
Okay.
And we're going to go next to Eva in Sunnyvale. Eva, do you have a question for the panel?
Yes, I have two kids who went through the school system, and their social security number was asked for. Why is it that they need the social security number at this young age? I thought the social security number was given when you start to work.
Okay, Deputy District Attorney Angela Alvarado, do you have any insights on that?
Yeah, I have to tell you, that's the first time that I've heard that. I have not heard of students being asked for their social security number in the school setting, and that is something that I'd like to look into if you would give me a little bit of time to do that. That's something that I will bring up because I have not heard that, and that's unique to me.
Okay. I'll have to look into that one a little bit more. Thank you for the question, Eva.
And the only other comment I would make, and I'm wondering if Angela's had the same experience, is you know, sometimes when folks are asked for a Social Security number, it's because that has become sort of the de facto way to identify somebody. But that if you ask and say, well, I'd prefer not to provide it, or I don't have it, how about I give you a different number that is manufactured exclusively for this purpose, that is sometimes deemed acceptable. I think proliferation of people's Social Security numbers in random hands, even if you've already got a Social Security number, not a healthy thing for people's privacy. So one of the questions I would be asking in those circumstances, A, don't want to or don't have one, how about we provide you with an alternative number that meets the same characteristics in terms of, and we use that.
Okay, good suggestions. Thank you. Let me remind people again that if you have a question you'd like to ask, please press 9. And we're going to go next to Larry in Cupertino. Larry, go ahead with your question, please.
Hi. Yeah, I get calls every so often from people claiming they're with Microsoft and that I have a big hole in my computer. Anybody could see my data. That they tell me, and I tell them that's baloney, and they say I have to turn on my computer and go to a certain site so that they can fix it for me. They want access to my computer, in other words. And when I tell them that, I'm really glad that they called because the FBI needs their phone number. They'd like to talk to them. And the guy gets really nasty. And I've had at least 3 different people call because 2 were men and 1 was a woman. So there's more than one person doing that, probably from the same group. But, you know, I'm 80 years old and I'm starting to get a little forgetful. It'd be easy for them to get a list of old people, I guess, and do that, but didn't happen to work with me. I want to know if there's an agency that you can report this kind of stuff to where they could do anything about it, or once we hang up, is that call gone forever and people wouldn't know how to contact them?
Larry, this is a great question, but I want to assure you it is not because you are on some 80-year-old list, because I get these calls all the time also. And my husband has to remind me, do not engage, do not engage. But it does. It makes me so angry that they think I'm going to believe this scam. And you are absolutely right. It is a scam, and it's very, very astute of you to pick up on that right away. This happens to households across our county, across our nation. They are from servers. Sometimes it's actually kind of alarming because you'll see a local number. And you'll think, oh, this person might know actually where I live. The best thing to do always is to report it to local law enforcement. They might not be able to specifically track where that call came from, but if they get enough calls, they will be able to post on their website or on Nextdoor or put something out in the community that says, warning, this person is calling and saying they're from Microsoft or Apple or Amazon, and they want to talk to you about personal information and get access to your computer, or scams that are having people say a family member is being held at the border or traveling internationally. All these scams are absolutely terrifying, and I want you to know that, you know, when we get them even at our house, I report them immediately to law enforcement. Like I said, they might not be able to do the kind of tracking that I wish they could, but at least they start to make a record of the trends that we're seeing, and they notify the rest of the community so we don't have more victims of the scam.
Remind people one last time to please press 9 on your phone if you have a question that you'd like to ask. And given all the things that you've been telling us, Angela Alvarado and Supervisor Simidian, about the scams and the threats that are out there, do you think that Angela Alvarado, do you think that digital safety is something that should just be taught in schools as part of the regular curriculum these days?
I really do, Melinda, and I can tell you why. When we really started diving into the digital abuse that we started seeing, and we started seeing it on an increasing trend, not in, only in our juvenile cases, but across the board. Almost every criminal case now has some element of either digital evidence or digital communication. I think digital safety is a life skill. I think it is a life skill, like we teach people how to play sports safely. We teach them how to drive a car, how to get engage in dating relationships. I think digital safety is truly a health issue for us, and that's why I know the district attorney's office, we've partnered with public health to really take a look at how to keep our communities digitally safe and healthy. So I think it's a life skill that should be taught starting as early as elementary school. And we give presentations to the elementary school students at their level, and we talk about things like make sure you have a password that's secure. Instead of using a letter and a password, use a number. Why don't you use, instead of spelling out great student, make it GR8. Little things like that teach our young people to make passwords that are strong.
And just on that note, as a follow-up, how many schools in Santa Clara County have utilized the digital safety program from the DA's office?
Well, I'm afraid to say this for fear that it might now double, but we did last year in 2016 about 48 presentations throughout our local schools, and every year the number goes up. It starts to increase because the demand is there. And like we were talking about how it's a life skill, it's also teaching our students how to manage their time online. And so we have a lot of presentations that have parents come with their students. Sometimes students come even with their grandparents. And we all get to talk and communicate on skills that are, like I said, they have the technology, but we have the experience. So let's talk about it.
Okay, Supervisor Simidian.
Well, only to say part of the reason I reached out to the district attorney's office to partner with me on this topic and to host today's telephone town hall was precisely because they've been out in the community. And what Angela's hinting at is that the more you do, the more you realize that there's more to do. So if folks are interested, I hope they'll ask. And there are going to be limits to how much we can do, but we're happy to try and host kinds of community meetings. You know, it's an interesting challenge because, while on the one hand we're talking about working with the youngest of kids, we're also talking about a whole group of folks who are in their later years, shall we say, who did not grow up as digital natives and who are, as one of our earlier callers were suggesting, you know, loving the fact that they have all this access at their fingertips, but beginning to understand more and more that that comes with a cost. And the cost is you've got to educate yourself and be smart about how you use the technology. So people should let us know if they think there's something that we can do out in the community. My office and the district attorney's office will try and put something together that responds to the need.
Okay. We're going to go next to Michael in Mountain View. Michael, please go ahead with your question.
Yes, my name is Michael, and I went to Europe, and my question was that how come we don't adopt something like Europe where it's very strict, where, like, if you break a law, you pay the penalty. It's not like if a company's $1 million and you fine them $1 million, they get off scot-free, or they elect the person back into office, and that we use more than just passwords, like we use face recognition or something else, because some people can't remember passwords, or passwords are very easy to get access to. People are very savvy and tech savvy, and like in Europe, it's almost like if you want to be a bank, you have to adhere to strict, very, very strict laws. Like here, they're just very, very lax. No one oversees the companies and sees they're doing a good job. It's our responsibility.
Thank you, Michael, for the question. This is Supervisor Joe Smidian responding, and I would say the short answer to your how come question is politics. That's the one word answer. The longer answer is begins with acknowledging that you're absolutely right. There are other parts of the globe where the commitment to privacy is appreciably greater, and we have a stronger regimen in place to protect people's privacy. That being said, efforts here at the national level have just come up short. Part of it is that it's a complicated set of questions and complicated trade-offs. But part of it is simply that there are big interests involved with significant dollar amounts attached, and Those are the kinds of issues that in our political system folks struggle with. I saw this repeatedly when I was in Sacramento legislating in the field. It was very tough to generate consensus, and I wish I could be a little more optimistic about what we're going to see here in the United States in the foreseeable future. But until folks at every level are hearing from their constituents that this matters to them, I think we're going to be stuck with what is really less rigorous set of privacy protections. Wish I could be more optimistic, but that's my experience. And in fact, I was just in Washington, D.C. last week talking with some folks there about these and other issues, and there was an acknowledgement that the issues are real, but not much optimism that progress would be made in the future.
Okay. Let's go to our next caller, Rahul in Cupertino. Rahul, please go ahead with your question.
Hi. I wanted to, first of all, thank all of the panelists, and I wanted to get their opinion on the one-to-one iPad initiative in the Cupertino, I think it's Fremont Union School District. A lot of students in middle schools are given iPads. They're not given iPads. Parents are essentially kind of forced to buy devices that cost more than $550. There's a lot of debate, not without really clear consensus, over if this program is beneficial to students or not. And I wanted to just get everyone's opinions on this particular subject, because I think it ties into privacy, data collection by corporations, maybe pedagogical discussion over whether or not this technology is useful, and then, of course, are these devices very distracting, or is it really beneficial to have middle school children with access to these to this technology in class and at home?
Rahul, that's a great name. I mean, that's a great decision, and that's a great issue to bring up. Sorry, I got a little bit of a cold here that I'm nursing. But that is something that we're all trying to figure out. The school districts are very different. Some school districts get a real consensus of parents that say, I want my student to understand technology, and we want here in Silicon Valley to be on the cutting edge of using these devices. We want to be the gold star standard for having our students know how to create and innovate on these devices. Then there's another group of parents that will feel very differently about that and say, you know, I just feel like we've got enough technology. So it's really an individual district decision, but I encourage you, if you really feel strongly that this is too much technology, this is too much pressure, too much access for students, school board meetings, talking to your superintendents, really getting, like Supervisor Simidian was saying, being vocal about it is a really important thing to have. But I just wanted to make sure that you can hear from our perspective. When we are trying to educate on digital safety, we're also talking about having our students realize what they need technology for and what they really don't. And that's something to really encourage at home, too, is innovation, communication, and creativity. Those are all wonderful things that all of our students want to learn. But how do we balance that in terms of telling them, you know, you don't need it to survive? That's what we're trying to all figure out.
Rule, this is County Supervisor Joe Simidian responding as well. A couple of observations. The first is you mentioned the significant cost. California state law is pretty clear about the fact that you don't have to pick up those kinds of costs. I'm not talking about, you know, incidentals like pen and paper. I'm talking about the kind of hundreds of dollars that you're describing. So I think while there may be a move to encourage students and families who have the wherewithal to acquire their own devices, if the device is required, then it's got to be something that is a district absorbed cost rather than a cost imposed on individual families. Follow up, I would questions. But the other point that I want to get to is, you know, I do think on the one hand, I think it's smart for local districts to say, this is the way kids are going to learn, this is the way they're going to access information. We're clearly headed down a path that is going to see acceleration in terms of the use of technology. But coming with that has to be the commitment to teaching the kids how to protect themselves online, how to protect their privacy, how to make sure that their personal information doesn't get monetized, commoditized by somebody for financial advantage. So I think what I would be saying, if you were concerned in your circumstance, is to say, hey, all well and good that we're going to be 21st century about the way the kids learn and about learning the technology they'll need to be lifelong learners, but coming with that is the responsibility to make sure that these kids are trained on how to protect themselves and to keep their confidential information. That's the shared responsibility, it seems.
We've been talking a lot about how people can try to be proactive and protect themselves and their information online, but what can a person do to clean up their digital footprint if they have been the victim of identity theft? Angela Alvarado, I'll go to you first on this.
Well, I think the first thing that people should do, if they have been a victim of identity theft, if they have had their personal information compromised, go to their local police department and find the officer that has knowledge on high-tech security and how they can help them, assist them through the process. That would be the first thing. They can always call the district attorney's office also. We have our consumer protection unit. We have many district attorneys and prosecutors that are working out in the community that will help people online figure out how to secure their personal information. And that would probably be my first recommendation.
Okay, Supervisor Simidian?
Well, the other observation I would offer is to monitor your various financial accounts in a way that's a little more rigorous than you typically might. I know a lot of folks tell me that when they get a credit card bill, they look to see the balance they might quickly. But if you've been a victim of identity theft or think you have, you want to start watching those bills very carefully for time. One of the frustrations, and we were actually talking about this a little bit before we began the town hall, one of the frustrations having authored the data breach bill all those years ago is that now the good news is people get notice if there's been a breach. The bad news is a lot of folks still don't take any steps after they've gotten word to make sure that they weren't, in fact, damaged by virtue of the breach, by which I mean take a more careful look at go through each line by line. Suddenly say to yourself, wait a minute, I was never in a Bed Bath & Beyond in Connecticut. What's that all about? Those are the kinds of things you have to do. And again, I know it's a bit of a nuisance, but it's candidly the trade-off for the benefits of being in an online world. And generally checking the credit report to make sure that no one has annual access that's free from the major credit report providers. Again, they all take a little time, they all involve a little bit of nuisance, but particularly if you've been given notice of a data breach, you want to make sure that you followed up, and if you know you've been a victim of identity theft, you want to make sure that there aren't other matters out there to be concerned about that you weren't in.
Going back to Angela Alvarado, along the same lines, what can schools do if there is digital abuse happening on their campus?
If there's digital abuse happening on a campus, the first thing that a campus needs to be proactive with is restoring campus culture. We forget that our young people, they have a digital community. They have an online community. They have a school community. So much happens behind the scenes for our students that we don't find out has happened on the school campuses sometimes until months later. So what we tell schools to do is act fast, act immediately for two reasons. Number one, you need to restore campus culture. That means you need to make your students feel like the world online might be chattering about something, but this is a safe place for you. This is a safe place where you're here to learn. That's your first focus, is learning. So schools need to either contact our office, the district attorney's office, and have us come out and do either our digital safety presentations or do focus groups. We have girls' circles that we talk about digital abuse in. We have, you know, young students that we talk about being leaders in speaking up. We try our best to make sure that our campus is restored to a healthy place to learn. And then, of course, the other thing that I would encourage the schools to do is have lots of adults talk about it in positions of authority. Don't just have it be the health teacher, or don't just have it be, you know, the school counselor. Have it be the biology teacher who knows how to help kids online. Have it be everyone on staff that these students feel they can go to if something happens.
Okay, we have just a few minutes left. I'd like to thank you all for joining Supervisor Joe Simidian and Deputy District Attorney Angela Alvarado and me for this discussion. Before we wrap up, and I'm sorry that we didn't get a chance to get to every single question, I really want to thank those of you who did call in to ask your questions and participate. But before we say goodbye, any last words, Supervisor Simidian and Angela Alvarado?
Well, I want to give just a couple of exhortations that may seem slightly at odds with one another. The first is, I do think it's important, because this came up a couple of times, do let your elected officials know you care about these issues. There is a lot of work that, in my view, can and should be done to have a more rigorous set of privacy protections. As much as folks have struggled with this at the national level, California, as the eighth largest economy, I think now the sixth largest economy in the world, has the ability to set a standard that others follow. And so push on folks at the state level to legislate in the area, and pushing on the folks at the federal level is difficult to venue as that may be. Having said that, as I said at the outset, I really do want to underscore the fact that there are limits, even if folks craft good policy, put it in place. You know, the law can only provide so much protection, and ultimately it's on each. I grumble every time I need a new password, and you know, that it has to be a little more long, excuse me, a little longer and a little more complex than I'd hoped. I do. But again, you know, I've come to appreciate over time that it's on me. It's on each one of us individually, and that there's no guarantee. But you know, every police officer I ever met would say, you want to have a lot of good locks on your house, because you want them to rob the fellow down the street, which doesn't seem like a very charitable view, but I understand the point they're making. And I would say the same thing about your digital presence. You want to have a lot of locks on the door. It's no guarantee, but what we've learned over the years is people are going to go to the easiest targets, and you don't want to be the easiest target. Go with that.
Angela Alvarado?
Yes, to dovetail what Supervisor Simidian just said, this is the one area, like we talked about, where you really can be proactive. You can be proactive in protecting yourself online, and please reach out to us. It's one of our most popular crime prevention programs, our Consumer Protection Unit in the DA's office, and the creation of digital safety curriculum. So please reach out. It's a very important and near and dear topic to District Attorney Jeff Rosen that we really emphasize crime prevention in the digital safety world.
Right. I'd like to thank you all for joining us today. If you missed any of this discussion, it will be available online at supervisorsimidian.com. That's supervisorsimidian, all together, one word, .com. Thanks again to Deputy District Attorney Angela Alvarado and Santa Clara County Supervisor Joe Simidian. Thank you all for listening, and have a wonderful Sunday.